I'm James Lawler, and you're listening to Climate Now. The largest climate conference in the world, COP26, took place this past November in Glasgow, Scotland. Now, to better understand what happened and what didn't happen at this year's conference, I sat down with the editor of Climate Home News, Megan Darby, who attended. So we're going to hear from Megan soon. But before I get into my conversation with Megan, I want to give a quick overview of what COP is, how the meetings got started, and a brief history of the COP conferences, because it's helpful to have the context of what these meetings have been and what's been accomplished and what hasn't been accomplished since they started happening. So here we go. The COP conferences bring together representatives from nearly every country in the world, as well as numerous businesses, nonprofits, and non-governmental organizations every year in an effort to combat climate change. The roots of this annual meeting date to 1988, when the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change, or IPCC, was established to provide regular scientific reporting on the changing climate and associated risks. That was the same year that NASA scientist James Hansen told the U.S. Senate that man-made global warming had begun and was a real serious threat. Now, in 1992, 4 years later, at the Rio de Janeiro Earth Summit, United Nations member states joined an international treaty to reduce greenhouse gas concentrations in Earth's atmosphere. That treaty is known as the UN Framework Convention on Climate Change, or UNFCCC, and now has 197 member states, including all 193 members of the UN, plus Palestine, Niue, the Cook Islands, and the European Union. The first meeting with all of the members of the treaty was known as COP1, and was held in Berlin in 1995. COP, C-O-P, stands for Conference of the Parties, meaning the Conference of the Parties of that treaty. And the parties are all signatory to the UNF's CCC. So at COP1 in Berlin, countries made non-binding commitments to reduce greenhouse gas emissions. The next year, at COP2 in Geneva, we're at 1996 now, countries agreed upon binding quantitative targets, quote-unquote, limiting greenhouse gas emissions from developed countries, and prescribed that more precise reductions would be discussed at COP3 the following year. So, in 1997, at COP3, the parties adopted the Kyoto Protocol, a legally binding agreement for developed countries to reach certain emission reduction targets between 2008 and 2012, based on a 1990 base level, or earlier. However, the United States refused to ratify the agreement. The U.S. Clinton administration had signed the Kyoto Protocol, but it was never submitted to the Senate for ratification because the U.S. Senate had previously passed a resolution that any international agreement that didn't require developing countries to also make emissions reductions would harm the U.S. economy. And China and India were exempt as developing nations, leading to 9 years of negotiations without a lot of progress. All right, so in 2004, Russia and Canada finally ratified the Kyoto Protocol, and it went into effect in 2005. Canada, whose emissions increased more than 17% above 1990 levels by 2009, announced their withdrawal from the protocol in 2011. Andorra, Palestine, South Sudan, the United States, and Canada are now the only UNFCCC signatories that are not part of the Kyoto Protocol. All of the countries that were party to the protocol successfully met their targets, largely due to the financial crisis, the breakup of the Soviet Union, and the purchase of carbon offsets in other countries. Yet, global emissions still increased by 32% from 1990 to 2010. The protocol was extended to 2020 during a conference in Doha, but Russia, New Zealand, and Japan did not take on new targets. Today, in 2021, global emissions have increased from 1990 levels by 57%. Not good. In 2009, at COP15 in Copenhagen, the Copenhagen Accord was adopted, calling for emissions reduction pledges from all major economies, including China for the first time. Unfortunately, the conference was not successful at producing a treaty with binding commitments. However, due to concern over the expiration of the Kyoto Protocol at COP18 in Doha in 2012, parties agreed to work towards a universal climate change agreement by 2015. In 2015, at COP21 in Paris, the Paris Agreement was adopted. Under the Paris Agreement, all signatories must make non-binding commitments to reduce their greenhouse gas emissions. Every 5 years, they must submit new, preferably increased, greenhouse gas reduction targets. Due to COVID-19, the 2020 conference was postponed, so this year's COP, which is COP26 in 2021, represented the COP where countries were expected to increase their emissions reduction targets in alignment with the Paris Agreement from 5 years earlier. COP26 was also important because a 2018 IPCC special report stated that in order to limit global warming to 1.5 degrees Celsius, emissions must decline by 45% from 2010 levels by 2030. It was at this year's COP that countries would share their 2030 emission reduction goals. So the question is, after COP26, are we on track to reach 45% emission reductions by 2030? Megan, great to be with you today. Let's start with your background and your history with the COP conferences.
Yeah, so I'm the editor of Climate Home News, and I've been with Climate Home News for 7.5 years. So my first COP was Lima, the one just before Paris, and Glasgow was the sixth COP I attended. So I've covered a few, but I wouldn't call myself a veteran just yet. There are others who have been going for decades. So my job is really trying to get the stories that are important. And in Glasgow, I was managing a small team of three reporters on the ground.
And where are you based?
I'm based in London. Climate Home has an international outlook in terms of the kinds of stories we cover.
So if you could do some table setting for us, for our audience, for those who may not know, we like to try to, you know, explain everything from sort of first principles, unpack any acronyms. What is COP? When did COP start? And what have the COPs achieved to date? A lot of questions there.
So the COP stands for Conference of the Parties, which doesn't give a lot away. So there are 197 parties, which are countries that negotiate at the COP. And this COP process, so Glasgow was COP26, so, and they're normally annual, so if you can count back 26 years, you get to 1995 was the first COP. And the process really started when the scientific evidence that climate change was real and dangerous was becoming hard to ignore. And so this was the forum for all these governments to get together and figure out what to do about it. It's been really difficult because the solutions involve overhauling the whole way the economy works and society works. And there are huge tensions between richer and poorer countries over who should do what and how that should happen. So that's why this process has dragged on for such a long time. So at the core of each COP, there is this negotiating process. And it's very, it's quite technical. There's a lot of specialized jargon. So if you watch one of these negotiations happening, it can be a bit bewildering to the uninitiated. It's like they're talking in code. And that's at the heart of it. But then around that, more and more over the years, there's become this kind of trade fair, these demonstrations, this very lively space where people are talking about what's it all means for their part of the world, for the sector they work in. So there's a whole sort of circus that comes with it around the core negotiations. So yeah, there's a lot of activists who show up. There's people from businesses trying to do deals. There are a lot of the countries have pavilions where they show off what they're doing in their country and hold side events. And, you know, so there's a whole lot going on. And of course, there are lots of journalists.
What are some of the most notable COPs that have happened over the years and what's been achieved at these various sort of milestones?
Well, I'm not going to go into the early history, but I will tell you about the Paris Agreement because I was there in Paris. That was COP21 in 2015. And that was when finally they landed a big all-encompassing agreement on climate change. And it was a big deal because the last time they tried to do that was in 2009 at Copenhagen. It all collapsed and, you know, it'd been really hyped up. It was Copenhagen. You know, there was a lot invested in getting a deal there and it didn't happen. And in Paris, they managed it. They landed that deal. And the way the deal was set up, everybody agreed on here's what we're aiming for in terms of limiting global warming. So We're trying to hold global temperature rise well below 2 degrees and aiming for 1.5 degrees from pre-industrial levels. So there was an agreement there on that's our goal in terms of the temperature limit. But it also recognised that the amount that every country was willing to contribute to that in terms of reducing their emissions, when you added all those contributions up, they didn't add up to the target. So it also set in motion this review process that every 5 years, governments have to look again at their targets, come back with something, and try and make it stronger than the last time as the technology develops, as people become more aware of what kind of solutions are available. And the Glasgow COP came at that moment in the cycle where everybody had to come back and with more and do more. So that's why it was really billed as the first major test of the Paris Agreement.
Okay, and so how did the test go?
So I guess maybe like a C-. You know, the process worked as it was supposed to do, in that most countries did submit something stronger. And there's been quite a shift in narrative. Net zero has really taken off as a goal that countries are aiming for. So this idea that ultimately you need to be, you know, emitting no more carbon dioxide into the atmosphere than you are absorbing from it through trees or technology, that you should ultimately sort of neutralize your impact on the climate. And several countries since Paris have set goals to do that by 2050. China has set a 2060 goal. And then in Glasgow, India's kind of surprised everyone. Prime Minister Narendra Modi surprised everyone by saying that India would do so by 2070, although we've yet to see the detail of that. So this idea has taken hold. A lot of countries, of course, having a long-term, like mid-century target is all very well, but what are you doing now? And a lot of countries have come back, you know, they've done the work, they have come back with stronger targets for 2030, for this decade as well. So the EU has notably strengthened ambition, the UK, the US under Biden has come in with an okay target. I think it was a range, it was maybe 50 to 52%.
Right. The US 2030 target is 50 to 52% reduction from 2005 levels by 2030.
So in terms of like the process, it has more or less worked as expected, but a few countries submitted plans that did not increase ambition since Paris. So Australia stands out, no change. There's just a sort of vague promise that, oh, well, we expect to exceed our target, but that we're not going to change it. Brazil, I think actually they sort of changed the wording around the deforestation target, so it's actually a bit weaker. India, Prime Minister Modi, like I said, announced increased ambition in Glasgow, but we haven't seen it in writing yet. And China's target was, there was no change to the headline target. There was just sort of incremental improvements in, you know, here's how we're actually going to implement it. So it kind of has worked as intended, but it's not enough. And the analysts who've crunched the numbers say that the sort of policies, government policies in place today put us on a path to 2.7 degrees of warming thereabouts. And if all the pledges made in Glasgow are delivered in full, you could get to 1.8 degrees, but that includes some of the sort of vaguer net zero targets. So it's still not at 1.5 degrees, and there's really a lot still to prove.
One of the key terms that you mentioned that's been gaining more currency, or sort of more, you know, is becoming more widely used, is this idea of net zero. And when we're hearing these net zero pledges that countries are making, to what degree are they based in achievable negative emissions versus sort of a more nebulous desire to offset emissions with as yet to be determined technologies or, you know, sinks?
Yeah, there's a huge range in the credibility of net zero. And that applies to both countries, national governments, and to corporate net zero pledges, because a number of companies have made these kind of pledges as well. So I would say, you know, the EU and the UK have pretty detailed analysis underpinning, you know, here's what we think each sector can achieve. And I think the UK net zero plan, there's about like 5% where they're not quite sure where it's going to come from, but everything else they've like, well, we know where the technology is going to come from to get there. And the social changes as well, because it's not something that can just be fixed with technology. It does require like broader engagement of the public in their choices. And then there are others that are a lot more just aspirational. You know, they still need to do the work, but they're saying, okay, we recognize that this needs to happen to tackle the climate crisis, so we're going to figure out how to get there.
There have been a large number of reports, or at least, you know, a number of reports from the IPCC stressing the importance of action within the next 10 years. Did you feel that urgency at all at the most recent COP? And if so, in what ways did it feel more urgent than previous COPs that you've attended?
Yeah, that's a really good question. I mean, you do tend to get a bit jaded going to these COPs, because every COP it's like, the world can't wait, you know, everything is riding on this. You always have, particularly like the most vulnerable countries, the island states, the poorer countries, you're saying, you know, coming out with, you know, talking about what the impacts of climate change that they're seeing now and the terrible impact it's having, and urging higher ambition. So you have that every time. But you also have countervailing forces of, you know, this sort of inertia of our dependence on fossil fuels and our demand for products that come from rainforest countries and involve, you know, drive deforestation.
In what ways are those felt? In what ways are those inertial?
So one example is the number of fossil fuel lobbyists at COP26 in Glasgow. Somebody counted it up, and there was more than 500 representatives of fossil fuel companies in
the talks. What are
they
doing there? What are all these people doing? What are all these lobbyists doing?
So they're holding a lot of side events promoting, I think, what we can call non-solutions. They're sort of presenting themselves as part of the solution and saying, oh, you know, we don't need to give up fossil fuels. We can use carbon capture and storage. Just sort of glossing over the fact that people have been trying to do carbon capture and storage for years, and it just hasn't taken off. So and the latest is sort of hydrogen. There's a lot of hype around hydrogen. Yeah, so generally I think fossil fuel lobbyists, they come and they sort of present solutions that don't require ending the use of oil, when really it's very hard to make the models work if you're not drastically reducing the consumption of oil, gas, coal. But one of the big breakthroughs at this COP was actually naming coal in the text, which this will be mind-blowing to people who have never interacted with this process before. But burning coal is one of the main drivers of climate change, and it has never before been named in the written outcome of one of these meetings. So that is in itself a big deal. And the reason for that silence is that some countries depend very heavily on coal, and it really underpins their energy systems. So it was a really big deal that at this COP, they're able to get something into the text committing everybody to phase down the use of unabated coal. So there was a bit of hedging in the language. At the last minute, it was changed from phase out to phase down. They talked about unabated coal, which means, oh, if you can make carbon capture and storage work, then you can maybe still burn a bit of coal. So there was a bit of hedging around it, but essentially it's saying, if you're really dependent on coal, you need to figure out a way to get beyond that.
My understanding is that India, which relies on coal, had the language changed to phase down at the last minute. Is that accurate?
Right. So, yeah, I mean, it was India who took the flak for that. They were the ones who spoke up at the last minute. But you'll also see that China did a bilateral deal with the US a few days earlier, which used the phase down language. So this was also the preferred terminology for China, and it had been implicitly endorsed by the US. And that's how you knew it was going to fly. And I have to say, phase out or phase down, it's still a really big deal for a country like India that, as you say, they depend heavily on coal for their power generation. And there are also some areas of India where mining coal is the main economic activity. And so there really needs to be some kind of plan for the regeneration of those areas if they are not to rely on that coal revenue in future.
Let's turn to other outcomes from COP26. So we've mentioned the phasing down of coal. What were some of the other notable outcomes of this COP?
I'd like to just elaborate on the coal point a little bit, because another significant announcement of the COP was a package of support for South Africa to transition away from coal. And that particularly focused on the social impacts of transitioning, which hasn't really been covered before. So regenerating coal mining areas. And so there was a package of $8.5 billion announced for South Africa. And it was very much driven by South Africa articulating its needs. And I think South Africa deserves credit for having significantly strengthened its ambition since Paris, and really put together its own commission and consulted different interest groups on how to do this. So I think, just to elaborate on that point, I think that was really important. There was a big announcement on methane coordinated by the US and the EU, but they got a lot of countries on board with a pledge to try and reduce methane emissions 30% this decade. And that's important because it hasn't really been a focus before of emissions reduction efforts. Carbon dioxide has been the focus, and methane is a stronger warming, has a stronger warming effect than carbon dioxide. And a lot of it is leaked in the process of producing oil and gas. Mm-hmm. So, and there's a lot of potential to prevent those leaks. So it's kind of a no-brainer, but it hasn't been monitored and reported as rigorously as carbon dioxide emissions. So there's quite a lot of work to do in really understanding what that means and what the action is going to look like, and holding countries that signed up to account. But 100 countries signed up to that pledge. So that's really putting it out there as like, okay, this is something we need to focus on. That's really important. On the completely opposite end of the scale of what these talks cover, because they're not just about reducing emissions, they're also about supporting countries with dealing with the impacts, and particularly enabling climate finance for developing countries to both cope with the impacts of climate change and to green their economies and develop sustainably. And the real sort of poor relation in these talks is known in the talks as loss and damage. So this is like when you are the victim of a climate disaster that wasn't your fault, can you get compensation or reparations? And until now, so there was a reference to loss and damage in the Paris Agreement, but there is still now no finance attached to it. You know, this really matters to like African countries or island states where, you know, they're at risk of losing their whole country, or, you know, places where people are reliant on subsistence farming, and they are, you know, finding because of drought that, you know, that doesn't pay anymore, and they have to migrate, they have to move to the city. People are losing their livelihoods, their homes, and in some cases losing their lives to the impacts of climate change, which they did not cause. So this is a sort of always been the poor relation in the talks. And in Glasgow, the Scottish government, which is not technically a party to these talks, but they pledged £2 million to loss and damage finance. And there was a dialogue started. Part of its remit will be considering finance for loss and damage. So again, it's a procedural outcome for the most vulnerable. But there is a sort of glimmer of hope of there actually being some kind of financial support. And the Scottish leader, Nicola Sturgeon, used the word reparations. This isn't an act of charity, this is an act of reparations. Most rich countries are not on board with that, including the UK. So there's been very strong pushback behind closed doors by all the rich polluters who do not want to cough up for this. But there is some kind of incremental opening the door to maybe having some kind of compensation for the victims of the climate crisis.
Can I ask on that front, What do you think those conversations are like, you know, when the negotiators for the rich countries are sitting across from the negotiators for the poor countries, and the poor ones are saying, look, we didn't cause any of this, we're suffering from it, we need something. What do the rich countries say?
Yeah, like, that's a good question. And like, I'm not going to defend it to you because I think it's morally indefensible. I mean, basically, if you are a vulnerable country and you come to these talks, any deal is better than no deal. Mm-hmm. Really? So when it comes to the crunch, the things that are priorities for the poorest and vulnerable countries, they get pushed aside. You know, the deal is done between the big powers. It's really hard. It's really hard. Like every time they come and they bare their souls, they do this, they're kind of expected to perform their vulnerability. Right. You know, they're expected to come with these stories of like, my islands are sinking and my people are dying. And, you know, they kind of take what they can get really when it comes to it. But I guess the most principled argument for focusing on mitigation is that, you know, the best adaptation is mitigation. Like the best way of coping with climate change is to prevent as much of it as we can. So that's kind of the argument for the rich countries focusing on cutting emissions.
Right.
And of course, most of the rich countries we're talking about are democracies, and whatever those leaders are agreeing in international forums, they have to then defend to their voters, or even if they're not democracies, they're still in some ways accountable to their people.
Right.
And their people do not want to give much money to other people on the other side of the world.
Right.
So there's just that kind of reality that people like to hold on to what they've got. And that's the main reason why, there's not much in this process for the most vulnerable countries.
And related to that, Article 6 of the Paris Agreement that deals with carbon markets was approved. What is Article 6 and why was that important?
So Article 6 is about carbon trading across borders. So there's part of it is setting up a new carbon market, and part of it is the rules around bilateral trades between countries. And this is kind of inherently controversial because under the Paris Agreement, every country, including developing countries, has an emissions reduction target. And it's going to get really complicated if I start invoking Kyoto. Maybe I just need to keep it simple. It's inherently controversial because it involves rich countries paying poorer countries to reduce emissions for them, and giving them effectively a pass to keep polluting. So a lot of activists are just flat out opposed to the whole concept. But the case for having that kind of carbon trading is that it helps to mobilize finance for climate projects in the developing world and enables them to be more ambitious than they would be otherwise. And it also allows the both parties to the transaction to aim higher than they otherwise would. That's the best argument for it. But there's a lot. The kind of history of carbon offsetting is littered with examples of projects that haven't delivered as much benefit for the climate as advertised. So there's a lot that needs to happen to make sure the loopholes aren't exploited, that those trades are actually adding to ambition and adding to emissions cuts rather than just giving polluters a free pass.
And the transparency framework of the Paris Agreement was also agreed upon at Glasgow. Can you wrap us up by explaining what that transparency framework is and why that's important?
Yeah, sure. So, and the transparency is, you can call it like a no-cheat charter. It's making sure everybody is reporting their emissions in the same way so that countries can hold each other to account. It's really nerdy. These are really nerdy negotiations. It's, you know, stuff like what format the table in Excel should be, and you know what the column headings need to be, and does everybody need to have the same, follow the same format, or can there be two different approaches for developed and developing countries? And you know, so there's a lot of detail to work out, but they did in Glasgow, they agreed on one framework for everybody, while recognizing that some of the poorer countries don't have the capacity to tick every box and fill every box, but everybody should be working towards those same standards. And it really matters for, like, China particularly. So the developed countries tend to have pretty good carbon accounting. And yeah, holding China to those same standards as a major emitter was pretty important. So yeah, so those were finalised in Glasgow, and those are important because it's a kind of precondition to any action that you actually have a clear picture of what your emissions are to start with.
That was Megan Darby, editor for Climate Home News, a global climate politics news organization, speaking to us about the outcomes of the recent UN Climate Change Conference, COP26, in Glasgow, Scotland. To listen to more Climate Now podcasts, watch our videos, or sign up for our newsletter, visit climatenow.com. If you're interested in attending one of our live virtual podcast tapings, you can also find those on our website. If you'd like to get in touch, email us at contact@climatenow.com or tweet us @WeAreClimateNow. We hope you'll join us for our next conversation.